GreenSense is brought to you by JLT Specialty USA, the world's largest energy insurance broker, serving the entire energy continuum. Visit JLTUS.com.
Welcome to GreenSense, a weekly look at the people, policies, and innovations that are changing our world. Here's Robert Colangelo.
Thanks for joining us. I'm a scientist, author, and environmental entrepreneur who founded and serve as your host at GreenSense.
I'm Bob Kessler, executive producer. This week, you know, there's been so much talk about bringing back American jobs. Some new jobs, a lot of new jobs, are coming about because of the solar industry, so we'll check in with the Solar Summit that happened recently. Also, toast beer is a good way to reduce food waste. It's done really well in England. They use leftover bread to make their beer. It's coming to the U.S. And Tom Appel of Consumer Guide Automotive will have some green automotive news.
All coming up on this week's edition of GreenSense. GreenSense leads off with Consumer Guide Automotive publisher Tom Appel with our green automotive news. Welcome, Tom.
Hello.
How have you been?
Very well, thank you. Keeping tabs on car stuff.
Well, I was out in Europe, and it was amazing how small cars are out there. And I had a really fun Ford Fiesta. I'm not sure if they sell this model in the U.S., but boy, was it peppy. Great gas mileage. And I'm just always amazed when I go out there how small the cars are and how good of gas mileage they get.
Yeah, the Ford Fiesta is a fun little car. It is sold in the United States, but it doesn't sell well. The subcompact car class is actually very small in the U.S., and it's actually shrinking.
Oh, amazing. And yeah, it was a tiny car, so I can see why it doesn't really fit well in the U.S., but there, where it's surrounded by cars that are even smaller, it seems to work well. But today, we're going to talk about a car I've never even heard of, the Kia Niro Electric. Why do you like this car so much?
Yeah, the 2017 Kia Niro, a new car from Kia. And for people who don't know, Kia is a division of Hyundai. But in the United States, Hyundai and Kia operate autonomously, so you don't know that they're actually from the same company.
That's why you're the guru of the gears. I never knew that. I thought they were two different companies.
They act as two different companies in the U.S., but they share a lot of technology. And the Kia Niro is one of those examples. The Kia Niro actually shares technology with a vehicle on the Hyundai side known as the Ioniq. And like the Ioniq, it'll eventually be available in hybrid, plug-in hybrid, and pure electric form. The vehicle that Consumer Guide Automotive recently tested is the Kia Niro in base hybrid form. That's the only version available for 2017. And we found it a surprisingly likable little car. One of the interesting things about the Niro is the question of whether or not it's a crossover. It looks a little bit like a high wagon, but it's not yet available in all-wheel drive, so Americans may or may not accept this as a crossover. But it's the same shape as things that we call crossovers.
What's the price point?
The vehicle starts at about $24,000. The loaded touring model that Consumer Guide tested came to $33,000.
And tell us about some of the features.
Yeah, one of the great things about the Niro, and at least one of the most interesting things from a market and branding perspective, is that Kia is not selling it as a hybrid. They're simply selling it as a family vehicle or as a functional vehicle for active lifestyle folks. But it is functionally a hybrid. And one of the things that it did in Consumer Guide Care was achieve 46 miles per gallon through four different test drivers here. So we're very impressed. That actually meets the city number, which is the highest number on most hybrids. It has an EPA combined rating of 43 mpg, which we beat nicely. But it drives around very nicely. It also uses, and this is strange for a hybrid, instead of a CVT or a continuously variable transmission, it uses a six-speed dual clutch transmission, which Kia says provides a more natural drive feel. I think it's a little bit clunky, but it does feel more like a regular car than some hybrids do.
Are there things you didn't like about it, Tom?
Apart from that, the transmission behavior, no, it's actually, as you know, we've met in person, I'm a very big guy, but I fit very comfortably in the Kia Niro, and it passes what I call the four Tom test, which means that I could sit in all four positions comfortably.
I never heard that one before. I'll have to put that in the memory bank.
The four Tom test. It works for big and tall guys. But yeah, the Niro is going to do well. Last month, it outsold the Toyota Prius, which is sort of a benchmark in that class. But again, Kia is trying to sell it as a family vehicle, as an active lifestyle vehicle that just happens to get good mileage. And they're not using the word hybrid in their advertising.
Well, Tom, we really appreciate you taking time to tell us about this, and we'll talk to you in a couple of weeks.
Sounds great.
That's Tom Appel. Read his articles and car reviews at consumerguide.com. And remember to subscribe to the Green Sense Radio podcast. Visit greensensefarms.com and click Radio Show. We're on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. Beer is proof that God loves us and wants us to be happy. It's a quote often attributed to Benjamin Franklin, and it turns out it wasn't quite what he said, but it's a good way to start this next segment. Toast Ale is brewed with surplus fresh bread. To tell us more about their innovative brewing process and unique business model is Madeline Holtzman of Toast. Madeline, welcome to Green Sense.
Thank you so much for having me, Robert. Happy to be here.
Madeline, what's your role with Toast?
I am on the ground in New York City. As of right now, I am the only person in the U.S. working to bring this business to life. So wearing basically every hat possible right now.
Well, working for a beer company and doing everything sounds pretty good. It sounds like you
definitely can't complain.
Well, according to your website, Toast Ale is brewed with surplus fresh bread that would otherwise be wasted. How much bread do you use, and how much food waste do you divert from landfills?
Sure. So our typical batch sizes will be about 30 barrels to start, which is 60 kegs worth of beer. And for each batch that size, we are saving 500 pounds of bread from landfill. So our goal within 1 year is to save about 10,000 pounds cumulatively.
Where does the surplus bread come from, and how do you know it's safe to use?
Sure. So we have been super lucky. We basically work directly with wholesale bakeries who have a massive quantity of surplus left over essentially every day of the week. So they bring us their bread directly from their facilities. So that's how we know it's safe. It's coming directly from a bread manufacturer. It couldn't be more fresh, honestly.
So this isn't waste bread. It's just bread that did not sell. So what's in the bread that can be used to make beer?
So it's really the long chain carbohydrates in the bread or the starch that we are extracting and obviously fermenting into alcohol. So it's to put it really simply, it's the sugar content that bread contains.
Does beer made this way taste different?
It really doesn't. And it's been funny how people who have sampled our pilot batch are so surprised. They're like, oh, this just tastes like good craft pale ale. And we're like, yeah, that's the point. We're just substituting some of the malted barley, but really it's just substituting one grain for another. So no, it doesn't taste different. I mean, it has a kind of malty character, but that's almost intentional. But it does not taste any different. I think that in a blind taste test, you wouldn't be able to tell.
Toast is a relatively small craft brewer out of the UK. Could all beer be made easily this way?
That's an interesting question. I guess I don't see why not. I mean, surplus bread, unfortunately, is not a resource going anywhere anytime soon. So I think that if breweries are willing to kind of experiment with using bread in their mash tuns, I don't see why every beer couldn't incorporate surplus bread.
In the UK, where Toast started, and they like their beer in the UK, half of the bread produced there is thrown away. Any idea what the bread waste figures are like in the U.S.?
Yeah, the only official data is that a third of all bread in the U.S. goes to waste. I personally can attest to the fact that it's much higher than that from having kind of been on the ground in a lot of facilities and even kind of doing some audits of grocery stores and bakeries, like going through the trash in New York City. I personally am very confident that it's higher than one-third, but the official stat is at least one-third of bread is going to waste.
There's many different types of wheat. There's wheat bread, rye bread, white bread. Do you use a specific type or can you use all types of breads?
We can actually be really flexible because, like I said, it's essentially the long chain carbohydrates in the bread that we're using. The type doesn't impact flavor much, which allows us to basically be able to truly take whatever is left over from a bakery that day. Obviously we wouldn't use like a garlic cheese bread because that would impact the flavor, but we can use a mixture of rye, wheat, white, sourdough, all of that.
Toast is also very unique in that you give all your profits to the charity Feedback in the UK, which is great. But what keeps you in business if you give away all your profits?
Yeah, that's a great question. So our model is, of course, that we cover our operating costs. And then after our operating costs have been covered, all the profits left over are poured into Feedback. The idea being that at the end of the year, we don't have profits left over that would go to shareholders. Instead, all of those profits go to charity.
Are you a B corporation or are you a nonprofit?
We are in the process of getting B Corp status. It's a process, but we are going to be a B Corp eventually. But we do not have 501c3 status.
And you're currently undertaking a crowdfunding effort to take Toast Al to the USA. How's that going?
It's going well. We just hit one third of our goal, the same amount of bread that officially goes to waste. So we are feeling pretty good about it. Definitely have had a lot of support from friends and family and a lot of really, really awesome media coverage. So it's going well, obviously hoping that it picks up and that we get the other two thirds of the way there. But for where we are, I think we're in a pretty good position.
And what is your goal?
Our goal is $35,000, and we set that because that's the amount of capital we need to essentially ensure that we can brew our first 100 barrels of beer, which is basically our first three batches, and that's what we figure we need to cover so that we kind of have a sustainable business model in place.
Well, Madeline, we wish you the best of luck. We think you have a clever idea that's both good for the community through the profits you give back to feed those that are in need, and also by diverting waste from landfills. We wish you the best of luck and hope you hit your goal.
Thank you so much. Really, really appreciate it. It was good chatting.
That's Madeline Holtzman of Toast, beer made from leftover bread. I'm Robert Colangelo, and this is Green Sense. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play when you visit greensensefarms.com.
This is Bob Kessler, executive producer of Green Sense Radio. Every week, we cover environmental issues and meet passionate people and sustainable innovators. You might have noticed we do it with very few commercials. Our advertisers, they're just part of what supports Green Sense. We need the help of our listeners, also passionate people who care about the planet and know the value of independent media, which matters now more than ever. We've just launched our fundraising drive so you can help us continue to bring you informative and inspiring shows. Your contributions will cover our small production staff, which seeks out and schedules interviews, edits them, and puts together Green Sense every week. Plus, there's the cost of online hosting and studio equipment. So when you visit greensensefarms.com, click on Radio Show to make a contribution via Podbean. It takes just a few minutes, and as we often say on the program, individual actions multiplied by millions can yield big results. So if you're inspired by our positive and informative shows, we're asking you to help keep Green Sense going. Visit greensensefarms.com and click Radio Show to contribute to our fundraising drive via Podbean. On behalf of all of us at Green Sense Radio, thank you.
GreenTech Media recently hosted its 10th annual Solar Summit, and to give us an overview of where the industry is headed, we have Stephen Lacey, GreenTech Media's editor-in-chief. Welcome to GreenSense, Stephen.
Thanks for having me, Robert. A pleasure.
Solar power in the U.S. continues to grow, with it accounting for 39% of all new electricity generation capacity last year. The year before that, it overtook oil and gas and coal as a major U.S. employer. This was your 10th year for your solar summit. What's been the biggest change that's happened in that period?
Everything. The industry has changed so dramatically. You know, we're putting on gigawatts and gigawatts of projects now. And when we started the conference, the industry was putting on hundreds of megawatts every year. So with that scale comes more sophisticated business models, new types of customers, new types of policies to support the industry, interesting new markets that are opening up in states all across the country. And, you know, I think the industry is just becoming a lot more mature. It's now being taken seriously as a power provider. It is the dominant new form of capacity in the United States. It beat out natural gas and wind last year. That is a remarkable feat. And I don't think that anybody thought that that would happen a decade ago. I mean, we all expected solar to grow explosively, but to imagine solar as dominating both wind, natural gas, coal, everything, you know, it's just pretty remarkable to think about.
What about subsidies and government incentives? How have those changed over the last 10 years?
Well, you've seen a number of states decide to implement what's called net metering, and your readers, your listeners may be pretty familiar with net metering. This is a utility policy that allows customers who own rooftop solar to sell their electricity back through the grid with through retail rates. So this is a very popular policy. It's in place in more than half the states around the country. And what we saw was a steady rise in the promotion of net metering through about 2012, 2013. And then after that, utilities started getting worried about how much rooftop solar was getting developed through net metering, and they started pulling those policies back. And you saw regulators start to question what type of new rooftop solar policies should be in place. And so over the last couple of years, you've seen this really fierce debate over the future of rooftop solar subsidies. Meanwhile, on the utility scale side, I think that's one of the more interesting pieces. Historically, you've seen utilities being basically mandated to procure solar power, more expensive solar power, because of renewable portfolio standards. Well, pretty much, and that's just a state-level mandate to procure a certain amount of renewable energy. Basically, all across the country, utilities have met their targets. So why is solar expanding so quickly? Well, what they're doing is they're doing voluntary procurement. They're just finding that solar is now cheaper than any alternative. And many utilities are just going out and contracting for new large solar projects just based on cost alone. Meanwhile, you have major corporations like Walmart, Apple, Amazon, Google investing billions of dollars into solar projects to procure power directly, because solar is becoming cheaper than the alternatives for these large corporate players.
So solar is becoming cheaper, even though there is maybe a paucity of subsidies and government incentives available these days. Is that correct?
Well, there is the investment tax credit. This is the federal credit that was put into place in 2008. And then it was extended at the end of 2015, and this gave the industry more certainty. And so we're going to see a five-year phase out. It was extended for a couple of years, and then we're going to slowly see a phase out down to 10%. And this gave the industry a very clear time horizon. It gave investors a very clear time horizon. And so that caused a really steady pipeline of utility-scale solar projects. So this federal tax incentive that gives you a 30% tax credit on your capital costs is really important for the solar industry's growth. That will go away, but the industry's costs are continuing to come down, and everyone is happy with the phase out of this tax credit. So you do have some certainty. And then the worry is, of course, under the Trump administration, whether or not that tax credit gets repealed through a tax reform package. But that tax reform package is looking pretty unlikely at this point, so it's anybody's guess.
Well, it's nice to see that solar could stand on its own and that it makes economic sense without government support, because that was the plan long term, was to kickstart the industry, provide incentives, and then let technology come in and market forces drive costs down. Where do you see the biggest cost decreases in solar power?
Well, it's been in the module, actually. We've got this chronic oversupply of modules because so many manufacturers ramped up capacity to meet global demand. And this overcapacity has caused a very steep decline in module pricing. So, you know, a few years ago, you saw module prices over $1 a watt. And now you're seeing sales for roughly 30 cents a watt. And that's just, I mean, last year alone, we saw a 40% decrease in the price of solar modules. So solar equipment pricing, and more specifically, the module itself, is coming down very rapidly in cost. And those costs, the prices are coming down and the costs themselves are coming down to meet those prices. And it used to be that the solar module was the most expensive part of a system. And now it's actually labor and soft costs like permitting and financing. And so people are trying to chip away at those costs as well. It's really remarkable to see how far equipment costs have come down, and not just the module, in racking, in power electronics, in the cells themselves, in the materials that go into the module. I mean, everything is coming down, and the solar industry has just gotten so sophisticated at shaving out costs. We do not see those declines stopping anytime soon.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to Green Sense. I'm Robert Colangelo. My guest is Stephen Lacey, editor-in-chief with Green Tech Media. And we're talking about their Solar Summit, which was in their 10th year, and all the new innovation in the solar industry. Well, you mentioned that a large part of the conference was focused on solar software. What is it and what does it do and how is that helping the industry?
Well, it's a bit of everything. Mostly when we're talking about solar software, we're referring to business efficiencies. There are a lot of new pieces of software that allow residential installers and developers to locate places to put solar projects, either rooftops or, you know, greenfields and brownfields. They allow for better site assessment. So you can do all the hard work before you even get to the location. And that really shaves costs out of the development process. Meanwhile, residential solar installers are using software to better manage customers, to help design systems, to get them through the sales process. Because what we see is that customer acquisition costs are pretty stubborn in the residential solar industry. Residential installers are now getting beyond the early adopters and tapping into this new class of customers, many of whom aren't ready to buy solar overnight. So it takes a little while to make that sale. And if you have better software to both design the system, to encourage the customer to buy, to give them transparency and pricing, that ultimately helps lower your costs as a business. So and finally, we also have like grid modeling software that allows these companies to take utility data and their own data and to model where we can place solar systems on the grid to give them the best economic benefit and to make sure that they're a really solid actor on the grid. Because solar can play a very good role in helping reduce infrastructure costs on the distribution system if you place it in the right place. So software can pretty much help anywhere to lower costs and make solar a more efficient, better player on the grid.
One of the topics that you covered was the next decade of solar. What were some of the issues and prognostications that came up during that session?
Well, the next decade of solar is both remarkable and challenging because growth rates, there are some headwinds around the globe. You know, we see markets in some markets growing fast, some markets in free fall. This industry is very cyclical, but the macroeconomic trends are very clear. Solar is going to continue to grow, and it's probably going to be a dominating capacity source over the coming decade. That means we're going to have terawatts and terawatts of solar. What happens, though, is that markets start to change when you have all this solar flooding the grid at once. And so the rate designs really need to catch up with all this solar power. And if you don't restructure markets, solar can actually be damaging to the grid and to the economics of the electricity system. So what we need to see are rate designs that allow developers to co-locate storage and perhaps shift some of their production to later in the day when peaks ramp up on the grid. We need to see, you know, more sophisticated distribution grids to be able to handle all this solar power locally. And I don't think that regulators and policymakers are quite prepared for the amount of solar that's going to be hitting the grid over the next decade. Meanwhile, we need to continue to drop costs, because what happens in oversaturated solar markets is that solar is generating electricity all at once in the middle of the day. And if you don't have ways to manage that, then you're basically getting $0 for your electricity. You're putting electricity prices into negative territory, and you're not making any money as a project owner. And that's really challenging. So you need to manage it technically, and you need to be able to lower costs to deal with those lower prices on the grid. It's a good thing for consumers, but it can be very challenging for businesses. So what we're talking about is just an explosion of solar coming, and I think everyone's trying to wrap their heads around how to prepare markets for it.
Stephen, you're a wealth of information. I have many questions to ask you that have gone unanswered. We'll have to have you back on the show. But it sounds like a very exciting time for solar, and especially during a time when we have an administration that does not seem to be consistent with the rest of the world.
Thanks, Robert. Appreciate it.
That's Stephen Lacy, editor-in-chief with Green Tech Media, talking about the recent solar summit. I'm Robert Colangelo, reminding you to subscribe to the Green Sense Radio podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play when you visit greensensefarms.com. Thanks for listening to this week's show. Help us help you. Head over to the greensensefarms.com website, click on Radio Show, and support our Podbean patron drive. Now more than ever is the time to support independent media so we can continue to put on great shows that feature sustainable innovation like the one we're working on next week.
You know, we did a thing about floating nuclear power plants in China and how that could be happening. Well, there's already the world's largest floating solar plant in China. But did you know these things are scattered throughout the U.S., floating solar power plants?
Visit greensensefarms.com to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. You can check out the list of radio stations that air our show. I want you to stay fresh, keep innovating, because when you're green, you grow.
GreenSense is recorded in the Duneland ecosystem on the eastern shores of Lake Michigan at GreenSense Farms, the largest indoor commercial vertical farm in the world. We walk the walk and talk the talk, growing leafy green vegetables 24/7, free of pesticides, herbicides, with non-GMO seeds, conserving resources, and reducing waste. Watch us grow. The program is copyright Green Sense Farms, all rights reserved.
Green Sense is brought to you by JLT Specialty USA, the world's largest energy insurance broker, serving the entire energy continuum. Visit jltus.com.